Tonight we begin part one of the synthesis of yoga, the only part that Sri Aurobindo thoroughly revised. He took up that revision years after the Arya had been complete. The section that we're going to look at was revised first around 1932. It opens with the four aids. And even this first chapter in part one, the Yoga of Divine Works, already reflects a substantial alteration in the text as he originally prepared it. Even the first paragraph is different. This came out to the public on the 15th of January in 1915. 15-1-15. He had prepared with a lengthy series of articles which we've looked at. Those were only touched up here and there. This reflects his later views about yoga. And we begin to see how he brings that synthetic attempt with the gathered wisdom of another 18 years of practice into the picture. So we won't be zipping along through this chapter. It's a seminal piece, and so we will go through it a little at a time. The four aids. Yoga Siddhi, the perfection that comes from the practice of yoga, can be best attained by the combined working of four great instruments. There is first the knowledge of the truths, principles, powers, and processes that govern the realization, Shastra. Next comes a patient and persistent action on the lines laid down by this knowledge, the force of our personal effort, Utsaha. There intervenes third, uplifting our knowledge and effort into the domain of spiritual experience, the direct suggestion, example, and influence of the teacher, Guru. Last comes the instrumentality of time, Kala. For in all things, there is a cycle of their action and a period of the divine movement. The first two words, yoga siddhi, combined, hyphenated, demand a little explication. Yoga, from the root yuj, y-u-j, to unite, to yoke, to fasten. So a state of being yoked together would be yukta. Yoga would be the act of yoking, the act of joining, the act of fitting things together, of governing, of restraining, of enforcing a unity. Siddhi comes from the root Siddh, S-I-D-H, which is a weak form of Sad, S-A-D-H, with a long A, and we'll get to that because it's the root of sadhana. But Siddhi here means to accomplish, to succeed, to perfect. It is a state of rounded perfection, completely satisfying in its result. So he says that in this first sentence, doesn't he? Yoga Siddhi, the perfection that comes from the practice of yoga, can be best attained by the combined working of four great instruments. So it isn't done in a flash. You don't pick up the practice of yoga and achieve it in a moment. These four elements. First, there's the teaching. Then, there is your enthusiasm. And then, there is the guidance of the guru, and finally, kala, the time that it takes to work out the methodology until you arrive at the perfection that you aim for. So, we begin. The supreme shastra of the integral yoga is the eternal Veda, secret in the heart of every thinking and living being. Shastra is a word that means order, command, and instruction. And in typical parlance in India, there are 18 types of shastras. Normally we see it at the end. There's a Dharma Shastra, the Artha Shastra, the Kavya Shastra, and on it goes. But it generally means a kind of teaching. But Sri Aurobindo notes that for this yoga, his synthetic approach, we look for the teaching to arise from inside. Veda is a word that means knowledge. So, Rig Veda, Sama Veda, Yajur Veda, Atharva Veda are four different kinds of ancient compilations of great wisdom from India's antique past. But old is not eternal. They are born, each of them, Rig to Atharva, from a spiritual knowledge that exists beyond the play and the temporality of this world. So it is eternal, and yet it is also embedded in the heart of all beings, a universal reality, which is transcendent. So there is a great knowledge which is already embedded within and which we call upon in the practice of yoga to come out. We summon it forth from the recesses of our own being. The lotus of the eternal knowledge and the eternal perfection is a bud closed and folded up within us. We were imagining last week when we talked about the heart of sadhana folding out from within, releasing into vivid expression the powers that are always contained. And the same thing is true here. It's within us, and the pressure of our aspiration, the pressure of our concentration upon that which is enclosed, causes it to respond and to open. It opens swiftly or gradually, petal by petal, through successive realizations, once the mind of man begins to turn towards the eternal, once his heart, no longer compressed and confined by attachment to finite appearances, becomes enamored in whatever degree of the infinite. All life, all thought, all energizing of the faculties, all experiences, passive or active, become thenceforward so many shocks which disintegrate the teguments of the soul and remove the obstacles to the inevitable efflorescence. He who chooses the infinite has been chosen by the infinite. We've seen in his first chapter that he declared that all life is yoga. One of the great lines ever written in spiritual literature. And here is another. He who chooses the infinite has been chosen by the infinite. If something has awakened in you, an aspiration has been kindled, and you step towards the divine, it is because already the divine, watchful from above, has noticed in you that the preparation is coming to completion, and the hour has come, the auspicious hour, the hour of God, Brahma Muhurta, in which you can be summoned. He has received the divine touch, without which there is no awakening, no opening of the spirit. But once it is received, attainment is sure, whether conquered swiftly in the course of one human life, or pursued patiently through many stadia of the cycle of existence in the manifested universe. So Sri Aurobindo is writing this article in January 1915 about what it is that in us as an individual has to come into wakefulness for us to step forward and aspire and achieve. At the same time, the lead article in the Arya is, of course, the life divine, and he is writing there, man in the universe, applying the philosophy of the life divine to what is the individual's role in bringing the cosmos to perfection and bringing himself into full awareness of the divine transcending universe and possibly perfecting universe. So here, allied to that in the synthesis of yoga, he brings it fully to bear on the individual. What can the individual do? And here he decides. Nothing can be taught to the mind which is not already concealed as potential knowledge in the unfolding soul of the creature. So also, all perfection of which the outer man is capable is only a realizing of the eternal perfection of the spirit within him. We know the divine and become the divine because we are that already in our secret nature. All teaching is a revealing. All becoming is an unfolding. Self-attainment is the secret. Self-knowledge and an increasing consciousness are the means and the process. You've just seen the message a couple of days ago on the mother's birthday, which was released in the ashram. It was a quotation taken from something she wrote, appropriate here too. If the aspiration is there in you, if the will is there in you, it is absolutely certain that sooner or later you will succeed. And I am saying this for people who live in very ordinary circumstances, less favorable perhaps than yours, but who can, even so, learn to know themselves and conquer themselves, master themselves, control themselves. Therefore, if the conditions are favorable, you have a much greater chance of succeeding. One thing is always necessary, not to give up the game, for it is a great game, and the result is worth the trouble of playing it through. So, the infinite within you responds to the infinite calling you from above, and you step forward. Now, he has made reference here, and we know the divine and become the divine because we are that already in our secret nature. This is Bhagavad Gita. This is in the 15th chapter. This is verse 19 and 20 there. He who, undeluded, thus knows me as the Purushottama, he, the all-knowing, adores me in every way of his being. Thus, by me, the most secret Shastra has been told, O sinless one, absolutely to know it is to be perfected in understanding and successful in the supreme sense. Secret Shastra. Guhyatamam Shastram. So if there is a secret, it's that the perfection already resides within, awaiting our sincere exploration and the application of all our energies to fulfill it in every part of our being. He goes on, the usual agency of this revealing is the word, the thing heard, Shruta. The word may come to us from within, it may come to us from without, but in either case, it is only an agency for setting the hidden knowledge to work. And here we see the distinction between the divine word, Shruta, which is organized into a body of spiritual knowledge, Shruti, versus Shastra, which is the externalized teaching. It's the mechanistic approach to things. It's the learning as codified. But Shruta, the divine word, is more powerful and more compelling. The word within may be the utterance of the inmost soul in us, which is always open to the divine. Or it may be the word of the secret and universal teacher who is seated in the hearts of all. Bhagavad Gita, chapter 18, verse 61. There are rare cases in which none other is needed. For all the rest of the yoga is an unfolding under that constant touch and guidance. The lotus of the knowledge discloses itself from within by the power of irradiating effulgence, which proceeds from the dweller in the lotus of the heart. Great indeed, but few are those to whom self-knowledge from within is thus sufficient, and who do not need to pass under the dominant influence of a written book or a living teacher. There are examples of people who do not have to go through that, but it is the ordinary method. It is the usual method, and it is a respected method to have the teaching, to have the teacher, and to follow the course of a gradual development. Ordinarily, the word from without, representative of the divine, is needed as an aid in the work of self-unfolding. And it may be either a word from the past or the more powerful word of the living guru. In some cases, this representative word is only taken as a sort of excuse for the inner power to awaken and manifest. It is, as it were, a concession of the omnipotent and omniscient divine to the generality of a law that governs nature. Thus, it is said in the Upanishads of Krishna, son of Devaki, that he received a word of the Rishi Gora and had the knowledge. So Ramakrishna, having attained by his own internal effort the central illumination, accepted several teachers in the different paths of yoga, but always showed in the manner and swiftness of his realization that this acceptance was a concession to the general rule by which effective knowledge must be received as by a disciple from a guru. We could say that this is true also of Sri Aurobindo. He's too modest to say it, but he needed no real introduction to yoga. His teacher for the moment, Lele, in 1908, sat him down and said to him, "Watch your thoughts. as they tried to swim into your head, stop them. And he did. And within minutes, had the central realization, which over a 3-day period became an utter absolute silence that was not broken. That is a mighty realization. He says that something of it was true about Krishna. Well, this is a reference to the Chandogya Upanishad. This is in 3.17.6, if you want to look it up. Maybe it's worth reading. So, Gaura Angirasa expounded this well-known doctrine to Devaki's son Krishna and said, "Such a knower should, at the time of death, repeat this triad. You are the imperishable, Akshitam. You are the unchangeable, Achyutam. You are the essence of prana. He became thirstless, Apipassaha." Then two ricks are cited from the Rig Veda. "Who see everywhere the light of the Ancient One, who is the seed of the universe. May we, perceiving the highest light, which dispels darkness, reach it. Having perceived the highest light in our own heart, we have reached that highest light, which is the dispeller, shining in all the gods. Yes, we have reached that highest light." Rig Veda 8.6.30 and Rig Veda 1.50.10. Highest light, Uttaram Jyoti. So, this realization that Krishna got was instantaneous. As soon as his guru uttered it, it entered into his being, awakened that which was already there, and it came flooding forth as a powerful realization. The Chandogya Upanishad is one of the oldest. So this takes Krishna as a historical personage back thousands of years. Yes, Krishna really existed, and he hardly had to try to realize the divine. He knew what it meant to find that highest light that was above within his own being and to become conqueror of death. So, Sri Aurobindo also refers to Sri Ramakrishna, who was very dear to him as an exemplar of yoga, who would pick up one sadhana, one spiritual discipline, and then another, and always move swiftly to the result, whatever he did. He would accept a teacher. He was very humble, but clearly he needed no teacher. You needed to simply point out the direction to him, and he knew the way. But he was happy to have your, quote, assistance. One might also remember from the Chandogya Upanishad also, the story about Satyakama Jabala. That's, I think, it begins in the fourth section and is the fourth, I should say the fourth chapter, and is the fourth section in that, I think, who is approaching his teacher, Gotama. I won't tell the story now. We'll probably do that another time. But immediately is recognized as a true aspirant and then given charge of a number of cows, which are symbols of light. And he goes away to herd these cows, which are 400 in number, and he says, "I won't return until they are 1,000. So already he has spiritual effulgence. The symbol is telling us that he won't return until he has perfected it, carried it to infinity. That's what 1,000 means. So when he reaches 1,000, the chief of the cattle the bull comes and says to him, "The hour has come. We are 1,000 now when we can go back." And so there is a return back to life. There is a search for the splendor, a capturing of it, a harnessing of it, bring it into a cohesive whole, and then a return to life. The numbers of examples throughout India's rich spiritual history could be multiplied, but worth spending a moment on that. Sri Aurobindo continues, "But usually, the representative influence occupies a much larger place in the life of the sadhaka. If the yoga is guided by a received written shastra, some word from the past which embodies the experience of former yogins, it may be practiced either by personal effort alone or with the aid of a guru. The spiritual knowledge is then gained through meditation on the truths that are taught, and it is made living and conscious by their realization in the personal experience. The yoga proceeds by the results of prescribed methods taught in a scripture or a tradition and reinforced and illumined by the instructions of the master. This is a narrower practice, but safe and effective within its limits because it follows a well-beaten track to a long familiar goal." So, sadhak, we had made note of the verb sad, S-A-D-H, which is to go straight to a goal and therefore to prosper. So a sadhaka is one who is going towards a chosen goal, and when he gets there, by the means of the sadhana, the path that takes him there, then he will achieve the perfection he seeks. A guru means commonly a teacher, but it really means who is heavy, who has substance. So the guru isn't some big, jolly, heavy fellow, but somebody who has the power of expression, who has the knowledge to impart. For the sadhaka of the integral yoga, it is necessary to remember that no written shastra, however great its authority or however large its spirit, can be more than a partial expression of the eternal knowledge. He will use, but never bind himself even by the greatest scripture. Where the scripture is profound, wide, Catholic, it may exercise upon him an influence for the highest good and of incalculable importance. It may be associated in his experience with his awakening to crowning verities and his realization of the highest experiences. His yoga may be governed for a long time by one scripture or by several successively. If it is in the line of the great Hindu tradition, by the Gita, for example, the Upanishads, the Veda. Or it may be a good part of his development to include in its material a richly varied experience of the truths of many scriptures and make the future opulent with all that is best in the past. But in the end, he must take his station, or better still, if he can, always and from the beginning, he must live in his own soul beyond the limitations of the word that he uses. The Gita itself thus declares that the yogin in his progress must pass beyond the written truth, Shabda Brahmati Vartate, beyond all that he has heard and all that he has yet to hear, Shrutavyasya Shrutasya Cha. For he is not the sadhaka of a book or of many books, he is a sadhaka of the infinite. Now, it's interesting that Sri Aurobindo quotes the Gita here and makes subtle reference to it throughout, because at this point in the aria, he has not started writing about the Gita yet. He doesn't pick up the Gita until, I think it's the 15th of August, 1916. So he's a year and a half away from even touching it. But the Gita is so compelling, a synthetic argument from ancient times, that it has to come in now. And he writes in that first essay on the Gita, it's titled Our Demand and Need from the Gita, we belong not to the past dawns, but to the noons of the future. Taking us there beyond the Upanishads and the Tantra and everything that we have seen and experienced before, to something new, which is the whole force of his sadhana, is to take him to the supramental consciousness. So here, this paragraph captures that perfectly. We can't be bound, even by what seems to be perfect, even by the enunciations, wonderful though they are, from the Upanishads. And there is hardly anything in literature anywhere which is as grand and soul-opening as some of those declarations from especially the earliest Upanishads. We can't be caught by any shastra, because nothing can perfectly express the eternal Veda. That knowledge is above and beyond, and can always inspire new articulations of that timeless truth. Another kind of shastra is not scripture, but a statement of the science and methods, the effective principles and way of working of the path of yoga which the sadhaka elects to follow. Each path has its shastra, either written or traditional, passing from mouth to mouth through a long line of teachers. This would be parampara, the uninterrupted row or succession of teaching. In India, a great authority, a high reverence even, is ordinarily attached to the written or traditional teaching. All the lines of the yoga are supposed to be fixed, and the teacher who has received the shastra by tradition and realized it in practice guides the disciple along the immemorial tracks. One often even hears the objection urged against a new practice, a new yogic teaching, the adoption of a new formula. It is not according to the shastra. But neither in fact, nor in the actual practice of the yogins, is there really any such entire rigidity of an iron door shut against new truth, fresh revelation, widened experience? The written or traditional teaching expresses the knowledge and experiences of many centuries, systematized, organized, made attainable to the beginner. Its importance and utility are therefore immense, but a great freedom of variation and development is always practicable. Even so highly scientific a system as Raja Yoga can be practiced on other lines than the organized method of Patanjali. Each of the three paths of the Trimarga, the triple path of knowledge, devotion, and works, breaks into many bypaths which meet again at the goal. The general knowledge on which the yoga depends is fixed. But the order, the succession, the devices, the forms must be allowed to vary, for the needs and particular impulsions of the individual nature have to be satisfied, even while the general truths remain firm and constant. An integral and synthetic yoga needs especially not to be bound by any written or traditional shastra, for while it embraces the knowledge received from the past, it seeks to organize it anew for the present and the future. An absolute liberty of experience and of the restatement of knowledge in new terms and new combinations is the condition of its self-formation. seeking to embrace all life in itself. It is in the position not of a pilgrim following the high road to his destination, but to that extent at least of a pathfinder hewing his way through a virgin forest. For yoga has long diverged from life, and the ancient systems which sought to embrace it, such as those of our Vedic forefathers, are far away from us, expressed in terms which are no longer accessible, thrown into forms which are no longer applicable. Since then, mankind has moved forward on the current of eternal time, and the same problem has to be approached from a new starting point. The justification for a new synthetic yoga. By this yoga, we not only seek the infinite, but we call upon the infinite to unfold himself in human life. Therefore, the shastra of our yoga must provide for an infinite liberty in the receptive human soul, a free adaptability in the manner and the type of the individual's acceptance of the universal and transcendent into himself is the right condition for the full spiritual life in man. So find your own soul, realize your own psychic being, as he comes to call it. Merge into unity with the wide cosmos, but move into the transcendent reality, which expresses itself in both universe and individual. Vivekananda, pointing out that the unity of all religions must necessarily express itself by an increasing richness of variety in its forms, said once that the perfect state of that essential unity would come when each man had his own religion, when, not bound by sect or traditional form, he followed the free self-adaptation of his nature in its relations with the Supreme. So also, one may say, that the perfection of the integral yoga will come when each man is able to follow his own path of yoga, pursuing the development of his own nature in its upsurging towards that which transcends the nature. For freedom is the final law and the last consummation. Mukti, freed, liberated, released into perfection. Meanwhile, certain general lines have to be formed which may help to guide the thought and practice of the sadhaka. But these must take as much as possible the form of general truths, general statements of principle, the most powerful, broad directions of effort and development, rather than a fixed system which has to be followed as a routine. All shastra is the outcome of past experience and a help to future experience. It is an aid and a partial guide. It puts up signposts, gives the names of the main roads and the already explored directions, so that the traveler may know whither and by what paths he is proceeding. The rest depends on personal effort and experience, and upon the power of the guide. A great place to stop. We'll take up another section, at least, of this chapter, the Four Aids, next time we meet. But that's the challenge. Look within yourself, find the truth that's embedded already within you, evoke its possibilities, let it speak to every part of the nature, and rise to the perfection that is possible. A little encouragement from teachings of the past, a word, imparted guidance here and there. Nothing, though, replaces your soul in its alliance with the divine. Here's a section from Book 5, The Book of Love, Canto 2, Satyavan. It begins on page 392. We'll read a couple of pages. All she remembered on this day of fate, the road that hazarded not the solemn depths, but turned away to flee to human homes, the wilderness with its mighty monotone, the morning like a lustrous seer above, the passion of the summits lost in heaven, the Titan murmur of the endless woods. As if a wicket gate to joy were there, ringed in with voiceless hint and magic sign, upon the margin of an unknown world, reclined the curve of a sun-held recess. Groves with strange flowers, like eyes of gazing nymphs, peered from their secrecy into open space. Boughs, whispering to a constancy of light, sheltered a dim and screened felicity. And slowly, a supine, inconstant breeze ran like a fleeting sigh of happiness over slumbrous grasses pranked with green and gold. Hidden in the forest's bosom of loneliness, amid the leaves the inmate voices called, sweet like desires enamored and unseen, cry answering to low insistent cry. Behind slept emerald dumb remotenesses, haunt of a nature passionate, veiled, denied to all but her own vision, lost and wild. Earth, in this beautiful refuge, free from cares, murmured to the soul a song of strength and peace. Only one sign was there of a human tread, a single path shot thin and arrow-like into this bosom of vast and secret life, pierced its enormous dream of solitude. Here first she met, on the uncertain earth, the one for whom her heart had come so far, as might a soul on nature's background limbed stand out for a moment in a house of dream, created by the ardent breath of life, so he appeared against the forest verge, inset twixt green relief and golden ray. As if a weapon of the living light, erect and lofty like a spear of God, his figure led the splendor of the morn. Noble and clear as the broad peaceful heavens, a tablet of young wisdom was his brow. Freedom's imperious beauty curved his limbs. The joy of life was on his open face. His look was a wide daybreak of the gods. His head was a youthful rishi's touched with light. His body was a lover's and a king's. In the magnificent dawning of his force, built like a moving statue of delight, he illumined the border of the forest page. Out of the ignorant, eager toil of the years, abandoning man's loud drama, he had come, led by the wisdom of an adverse fate, to meet the ancient mother in her groves. In her divine communion he had grown a foster child of beauty and solitude, heir to the centuries of the lonely wise, a brother of the sunshine and the sky, a wanderer communing with depth and marge, a Veda-knower of the unwritten book, perusing the mystic scripture of her forms. He had caught her hierophant significances, her sphered immense imaginations learned, taught by sublimities of stream and wood, and voices of the sun and star and flame, and chant of the magic singers on the boughs, and the dumb teaching of four-footed things. helping with confident steps her slow great hands. He leaned to her influence like a flower to rain, and like the flower and tree, a natural growth, widened with the touches of her shaping hours. The mastery free natures have was his, and their ascent to joy and spacious calm. One with the single spirit inhabiting all, he laid experience at the Godhead's feet. His mind was open to her infinite mind. His acts were rhythmic with her primal force. He had subdued his mortal thought to hers. That day he had turned from his accustomed paths. For one who, knowing every moment's load, can move in all our studied or careless steps, had laid the spell of destiny on his feet and drawn him to the forest's flowering verge. Namaste. Jai Ma.